workplaces and communities by people with disabilities. Now, therefore, I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 2013 to be Disability Employee Awareness Month in Portland. Encourage all residents to join in this observance. So let's hear it for our employees that are living proof that this is a good public policy. Thank you all for your service. Any council comments? Anyone signed up on this item?
I did not have a sign-up sheet.
Joe wants to speak. We'll give you a chance, Joe. Come on up.
Since I am disabled, I would just encourage you, when you have a lot of people that are going to speak to the council, like we have a controversial topic called 2D2, the last one, we had 200 people speaking, I think, on the list, that you set up some priority of calling people up. Like, we used to call women with children or people that are in the audience with children. But also, I would suggest that you think about calling people up in wheelchairs, people that, like myself, that are on oxygen, that may be concerned about the amount of oxygen that's left. So those people, I think, should go to the head of the line. And it doesn't include me, because my oxygen lasts a long time, as you all know. So I'm not speaking personally that I want to get in front of the line. But because I am disabled, it's something that I think about. And as we put special chairs here, I think it was a year or so ago, that's really cool. So we're moving in the right direction. But it always annoys me that if somebody is in a wheelchair or somebody that is obviously having physical difficulties is sitting here hour after hour. And I don't think that's fair. And I know government isn't fair, especially at the moment. However, it's a simple thing we could do. Just say, hey, if you are disabled, come on up. You go to the front of the line if it is to your advantage, if you want to do that. If you don't want to do it, then, you know, you might want to just sit here and listen to it. So that's the only thing that I would say. We should be very proud of our people that are disabled. They do tremendous amount of work in the city, and I know some of them, kind of. And I think you all know, I just love staff. Don't particularly like politicians, but I love staff. So anyway, that's just a thought that you could toss around.
Thank you. Thanks. Other council comments, please?
Thank you, Joe, for that. And Mayor Hales and Commissioner Novick, you should know that our improvements to the council chambers were at Joe's advocacy a couple of years ago, I think now, in terms of having reserved seats for people and also for people who are accompanying people in wheelchairs. So I appreciate, Mayor Hales, you continuing the push for us to be a model employer of people with disabilities, your staff in the Office of Management and Finance, working with the Commission on Disability and also the Office of Equity and Human Rights. It's a very important part of our equity agenda for our entire city, and I'm very happy that my bureaus, Development Services and Parks, are going to be model bureaus for working with the Commission on Disability as well as the Human Rights Commission and the other citizen advisors in the Office of Equity and Human Rights to make sure that we are having the dual focus on disability along with other issues of equity in terms of race and culture. So thank you very much for having this proclamation.
Great. Thanks. Appreciate it. Okay, now the next one is on the subject of parks, a place where we're also trying to make sure that all Portlanders have access. We actually had a film crew here last week from the Today Show taking a look at the combination of these two agendas here, which is access for all in our park system, that is Harper's Playground, of course. I see Nick Hardig is here, and I'm sure, Commissioner Fritz, you have some comments. Let me read the proclamation first.
Let me read the title.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I'm getting ahead of myself.
964, proclaim October 11 and 12, 2013 to be Parque Diem, a citywide event in support of Portland's parks.
And here's the proclamation. It says, whereas Portland, Oregon is a city acclaimed for its outstanding quality of life, which is largely defined by its park system and natural areas. And whereas our parks and natural areas are in need of greater support, And whereas October 11th and 12th, 2013, is anticipated to be the largest citywide volunteering effort in the support of Portland's parks, natural areas, and community gardens in the city history, that's saying something. And whereas over 70 volunteer projects are scheduled to take place at 55 sites involving the participation of 40 community groups and organizations, and whereas volunteers contribute nearly 500,000 hours of service to Portland parks annually, one of the largest rates of volunteering of any American city, and whereas the people of Portland should be encouraged to support their natural areas and public institutions for the betterment of our city, and whereas Parque Diem is the inaugural effort for a citywide day of park system volunteering, now, therefore, I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 11th and 12th, 2013, to be Parque Diem, a citywide event in support of Portland's parks, and encourage all residents to volunteer in support of these days. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Hales. And if I might, I invite Nick Hardig, with the Portland Park Foundation, to come and tell us some more about this. I'm very excited to be part of this inaugural two-day celebration of Portland's parks and also celebration of volunteering. The two things together are like the perfect combination, I believe. And we're known for our strong volunteering and also for our wonderful park system. And the Parks Bureau appreciates the partnership with the foundation and with all of our volunteers who give us not only their hands and their strong backs, but also their hearts and minds to help us with many different things that we do in Portland parks. And so with that, Nick, please tell us some more about this event.
Thank you. We believe that we'll have participation from actually 40 different groups of people wanting to support their local parks, and we are optimistic that we could have 1,000 people volunteering. And people don't just volunteer because it's fun. They have busy lives, but they see need and they see the opportunity to help. So these are people standing up not just to contribute, but because they believe in the needs of the park system and they want to make it better and they believe in this city. So thank you for your help. We will get great work done and also raise awareness that even though Portland has a great park system, 1 in 5 families can't walk to a park, and we have a major backlog and other needs for investment, we believe, that people need to be aware of. Thank you.
And Nick, how could somebody find out where to join a volunteer effort?
We would love for people to go to our website, parklandia.org, and they can see an interactive map and select the project near them, whether it's family-friendly that they seek or pruning rose bushes. They can find a great project for them. Thank you.
There are projects for all abilities, and indeed we probably need assistance with registration and other things for folks who have less strong backs or hands like mine that get arthritic after a little bit. Nick and I will both be at events both Friday morning and Saturday morning. I encourage folks to join in. You never know where a city commissioner or a mayor might show up. So we would really appreciate your partnership. I want to particularly mention in conjunction with the previous item that I visited the Portland Memory Garden last weekend, which is a different kind of garden from Harper's Playground, which is for all abilities for young children. The Memory Garden is particularly geared towards seniors with memory impairment, and it's an absolutely wonderful place. They have a huge pile of bark chips that they need to be spread in the adjacent community garden. So if you're looking for a volunteer project that's short and when it's done, it's done, go to the Memory Garden. I think it's on Saturday morning. But that's just an example of you can pick something that's a little piece of the effort, like pulling ivy in Forest Park, or you can pick something that you can dust off your hands and go watch football by noon.
Great. And having volunteered along with a lot of other people in miserable weather to pull ivy or plant trees, my phone app says we're going to have 57 to 60 degree weather, partly cloudy, partly sunny. Perfect weather to move that bark dust, dig that drainage ditch, otherwise get out there and help the park system. So if there was ever a beautiful weekend, beautiful fall weekend to make a difference, this would be that time. So even if you're just a fair weather volunteer, this one's for you. Thank you, Nick, for all that you and the foundation are doing.
Thanks for your help.
So just, Nick, for those of us who don't speak Latin, what does Parque Diem mean?
Well, it's a takeoff from Carpe Diem, enjoy the day, seize the day. It's about Parque Diem is Park Day, and it's about engaging with your parks and supporting them. Thank you.
Whether or not, and I also just observe there's two ways for city employees to support Parque Diem. One is by volunteering, and the second is on the every year we get to elect where to put our charitable dollars through our employee giving programs. And the Portland Parks Foundation is an option, and if you pick them, it's automatically deducted from your paycheck and goes to great causes. And a lot of the parks and programs we enjoy in this city would not be possible without a strong Portland Parks Foundation. So thanks for your great work, Nick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, I just have to say that following up Commissioner Saltzman's comment, I did study Latin, and I was somewhat appalled by this phrase, but I also recall that the mayor made a commitment to me about a month ago that he would keep the puns flowing, so I appreciate fulfilling that commitment. And very pleased to see this proclamation and glad that so much great work is going to be happening this weekend. Thank you.
It's certainly a memorable name.
Well, E Pluribus Unum was already taken, so.
I need to also note that this effort is supported by hundreds and indeed thousands of parks employees who day in, day out are maintaining our parks and who are partners with the Parks Foundation in setting up all of these events. So thank you to the parks employees.
A wonderful partnership. They're great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. We'll see you out there. Okay. Now we need to move to item 965.
965, authorized contract with Motorola Solutions, Inc. to provide a public safety emergency radio system for a not-to-exceed amount of $18,289,174.
Sue did hesitate a moment on that because it's a big number and a big investment. So our team is here to make this presentation and tell us about the investment and what it will mean. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor, City Council. My name is Christine Moody from Procurement Services. And before you have an ordinance recommending authorization of a contract with Motorola Solutions in the amount of $18,289,174.26 to provide a public safety emergency radio system. Last fall, a request for proposals was issued, and in March of this year, three responses were received. A selection committee made up of seven evaluators, four city staff, one minority evaluator, one person representing Multnomah County, and one person representing Washington County from the Consolidated Communications Agency evaluated proposals based on the understanding of the RFP, qualifications and corporate experience, references, diversity, and price. The committee selected Motorola Solutions as the most qualified respondent, receiving the highest evaluation score. Motorola Solutions is subcontracting with two state-certified, minority-owned, women-owned businesses to provide services related to acceptance testing, antenna installation, project communications, scheduling, and documentation. At this point, I will turn it over to Jeff Baer, who will provide some technical aspects of this project.
Good morning, Mayor Hales, members of City Council. I'm Jeff Baer with the Public Safety Technology Revitalization Program, and we really want to thank you for the opportunity to present this information to you this morning. We do have a very brief slide presentation on the Emergency Radio Communication Replacement Project, but before doing that, I wanted to make sure that you each had a copy of Chief Technology Officer Ben Berry's comments on the project itself. He was unable to be here, but he did want to provide his written comments to the council related to the project. And I also want to thank our executive project sponsors, Bureau of Emergency Communications, who operates the system, and also we have representatives from Portland Fire and Rescue. Chief Jansen's is here, as well as Portland Police Bureau Chief Mike Reese and Assistant Chief Mike Krebs. We've had excellent input and coordination with all of our stakeholders, including those external to the city, and I'd also like to thank Christine and Procurement Services, as they really provide some really great guidance and advice as we've negotiated this agreement with Motorola. And with this, I'd like to turn it over to Carl Larson, who's from our office, to highlight some of the real technical aspects of what we're going to gain by having this contract executed with Motorola. And hopefully we can put this up there on the slide projector.
Morning. Mayor, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Carl Larson with the PSSRP. Last time I was in front of this body, Commissioner Fritz might remember, we talked about leaking diodes regarding the radio system. I misspoke then. It was a leaking capacitor, actually. But we have a lot of people involved in this project. Myself, my co-project manager, Mark Tanner, and many, many people, not only inside the city but outside the city as well. So we just wanted to thank all the hard work. And this project will touch every bureau in the city. It'll touch every public safety agency in the county, and it will be involved in mutual aid situations throughout the four-county area. So we're very, very excited about getting to this point. It's a mission-critical communications for first responders in the area and many non-critical responders in the area as well. It supports over 6,000 users on the system currently and has capacity to handle many thousands more in the region. And of course, we think about interoperability all the time with our surrounding counties. We have three other radio systems that we'll be interacting with, so it's very critical that we get the interoperability correct in this system. Over the past 12 months, just to give you an idea of how busy this system is, over 24 million push-to-talks or transmissions have been occurring on this system over the last 12 months. So it's a very, very busy system. It's on currently obsolete technology in the sites that we have. You might recall that we upgraded the controller, the core of the system, in 2010. And this is a completion of that upgrade that we have. And we're proud of the, you can't really see it on the screen there, but we have got a slogan down below. It says, Mission Critical Public Safety Grade Emergency Radio System, coverage, capacity, and continuity. And that's really the principles that we're using to move this system ahead. This is just a diagram of how the system is conceptually made. We're moving from a one-loop system or a one-simulcast zone system to a two-zone system. It increases our capacity, and we're increasing the channels, 20 channels on the west side and 16 channels on the east side. Just some of the goals that we've achieved so far in the project. We wanted to make sure that we had regional interoperability, which we talked about already, but we wanted to make sure that part of the charge we had was don't lose any functionality. In fact, if you can, increase the functionality of the system, and we think that we've done that in negotiations and in our preliminary design with the Motorola Solutions. We want to make sure that that's a stable, sustainable infrastructure. You know, in the past, it's been very difficult to make sure that you stay current with technology as we move ahead. And we think with our contract that we're asking for approval today, we've achieved that. This is some of the sustainment plan that we've actually moved into. We have the normal sustainment 24/7 coverage of the system. But if you look at that second block, the system upgrade agreement, we've negotiated inside this contract that's before you today, an ability to keep our system current every 2 years with the newest releases, the newest technology, and if necessary, the newest hardware through capitalization of that cost over the next 10 years. So at the end of a 10-year, 12-year cycle, this will start at the end of at acceptance when we accept the system. At the end of that cycle, we'll have a system that is with current technology in 10 years hence. So we're very proud of that. We took a look at, even though this doesn't fall within the normal technology oversight committee, they have a dashboard that looks at all of the potential risks inside a contract. So we wanted to use that to make sure that we were following that process and looking to make sure that we covered everything that we needed to cover. So you'll see that list there of everything that we've covered that meets the technology oversight committee's dashboard as well. We have a lot of eyes on this project, as you can imagine. We have the Independent Citizens Committee, and in conjunction with that, we formed a Citizens Committee for a Radio Project Oversight Committee. So those two committees get briefed on it regularly. Our Executive Steering Committee looks at this project program every time they meet, and we give them a status report on that. Executive sponsors, and Jeff mentioned them, BOAC, PPB, FIRE. All those three bureaus have been tremendous in their support in moving this along with BTS Communications and their staff as well, making sure that we're covering all of the points we need to cover. And then, we have project status reports, and we also have an independent quality assurance firm that is overlooking the project as well to make sure it's on track and on time. Currently, we're right where that red line marks is today. With authorization from you to move ahead and for Christine to sign the contract, we'll be able to move ahead and start detailed design work with Motorola in earnest. And we believe that the project will be complete sometime mid to late 2015. just a wrap-up of what we are asking, authorization for procurement to actually sign the contract and move ahead with Motorola Solutions. Our next steps, we'll finalize that design review sometime in early 2014. We'll be doing a factory acceptance testing, actually looking at the equipment up and running at their factory site in Schaumburg, Illinois. We'll be approving it there about the third quarter of 2014, or the spring of 2014, rather, and then final acceptance in the summer or the fall of 2015. With that, take any questions.
Questions for the team.
I have a few questions. So this is a contract of about $18.3 million, and it's a not-to-exceed amount. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
And, Jeff, you told me this yesterday, but for the record, talk to me about contingency in this contract, contingency.
Right. The not-to-exceed price does not include a contract contingency amount. However, we have project funds out of our overall budget of holding 10% back of the total amount for the entire project as a contingency.
Outside of the contract.
Right.
And then what is the dispute resolution mechanism? Is there some sort of binding arbitration clause, and is that clause under the laws of Illinois or laws of Oregon? Or
the governing law would be in the state of Oregon. We have that embedded in our contract. So any type of venue we'd have to go to court would be in Oregon.
So what? Yeah, is there a binding arbitration dispute resolution mechanism, or is there some contract dispute resolution mechanism?
Commissioner, I'll take
or does
a whack
it go straight
at that.
To the lawyers.
On the negotiation team, we did have a fine set of lawyers to help us through that. So we do have a dispute resolution that goes through it. I do not recall what it says, but we can get that to you.
But there is a provision in there.
There is. Okay.
And it is subject to the laws of Oregon.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you talked about this quickly, but it might deserve a little more unveiling, and that is you've set this contract up with automatic both software and hardware upgrades. So that what we did last time, you know, as an effect, went through a cycle where we bought new equipment, got it working, worked great. You know, it became obsolete as technology moved on, and then we find ourselves at the bottom of the curve again. Nobody did anything wrong, but that's just the normal way we buy things. A lot of the things we buy, say trucks, don't evolve as much as technology does. You've set this one up differently so that at that 10-year point, we're in effect current. Is that right?
Correct.
That's correct. What we wanted to do is really look at the investment we're making in the public safety radio system today would have a longevity over the next decade of being current system compatible. And the agreement we have with Motorola is a 2-year system upgrade agreement so that every 2-year cycle we can upgrade the software. And if the software requires a hardware component to have that system in place, that's also included in that cost.
So what if we want to add a new capability? For example, we have video capability in some of our police cars now. What if we have it in more of them? Or if some completely new idea like that comes along, what's our prospect for being able to incorporate that? Because, again, the pace of technological change, having just spent yesterday afternoon in New York City's real-time information center for their police and public safety agencies, I understand that this is a moving target. So,
and that's an impressive site to go to,
yes.
Mayor. I appreciate that. Well, one of the things that we have talked about with Motorola and in this contract is making sure that whatever we put in place today for our land mobile radio system is also compatible and can be used in conjunction with data technology. So one of the things that I'm sure you're aware of and the commissioners are aware of that broadband LTE technology is coming down the line. A lot of departments, both police and fire, want to use data to transmit video and text throughout their radio system. So we're making sure that the system's compatible with that when it comes online.
And has the band or has the is robust enough that can handle that additional amount of data?
We do. We have a lot of capacity on our system currently.
And to reiterate, is all the funding for this project coming from the 2010 fire bond, or are there other sources for the $18 million?
There's really two sources to that. The 2010 general obligation bond provided a number of different resources of about $30-some million for the project that we have today, but another $10 million came out of the Bureau of Technology Services Radio Replacement Fund. So we have a combination of funding sources together.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thanks very much. I don't know if we have any. Do we have any testimony on this item, Sue?
We have Charles Johnson.
Okay, come on up. I'm not sure if our chiefs are wanting to testify or here to answer questions, but I know they're here. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Charles Johnson, and I guess you can all feel great that the citizens have so much confidence in the process for this thing that I'm the only one that wants to talk about it. And I do think the city has done a good job. If we think back in the beginning, there were two other bidders that responded to this RFP. I was glad to hear, Mayor, that you've recently been in the RTIC for the New York Public Safety Divisions. I hope that you had a chance to talk with both administrative and entry-level people about some of the problems that have come up in previous implementations of Motorola Digital Solutions. The problem is, the biggest problem is, of course, is there's no other system that has less problems. So I hope that the prior workers on this contract have made sure that there are essentially allotted man hours to deal with the almost unavoidable problems that come out with large-scale technology implementation. And I'll also be checking back with you all later to see if among the many other organizations involved, maybe some of the Technology Oversight Committee people are involved. Our good friend, the lady doctor at Intel, would tell us that this program does not qualify as extreme scale. There's only really three extreme scale projects in the world, Apple, Facebook, and Google. But the main thing is that as we get further down the road, there's no reason to think that this contract is not going to be like any other large governmental contract where they'll say, unforeseen difficulty, and I hope that in the future there'll be more. There's an 8-page PDF that links to this, and it doesn't link to the entire contract, but we know that we're going to end up spending more hours than we originally thought to chase down bugs and stuff like that. So I was very pleased to hear Commissioner Schalzman get to what on an $18 million contract is the nitty-gritty, what will be the venue, and how scared can we keep them so we don't actually have to litigate, so that they actually say, oh, well, we're going to throw in another project manager, $100,000 a year person, to find out why the east side has problems talking to the west side as they've broken up the channel loops. But I do want to say that congratulations to all the people who have worked in this project before. Motorola is a good provider, even though they've split. I grew up on a Motorola TV made in Illinois, and now they've split up so that the phones are made by Google, some products in Texas, and the Solutions Group has good products coming out of Illinois, even though, of course, we know there's not as much American content as we might like. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Okay, further council discussion. This is an emergency ordinance, and we're ready for a roll call.
Novick.
Aye.
Fritz.
Well, thanks to Christine Moody and Jeff Bayer and Carl Larson for your work on this. If I had any concerns about it whatsoever, they would dispelled when you started your testimony correcting a misstatement from months ago regarding a leaking diode versus a leaking capacitor. And I think that's the kind of detail that's absolutely necessary on this project. I also salute Lisa Turley in Emergency Communications and Carmen Merlo in Emergency Management, both of whom have been following this project. I also liked seeing the six oversight committees or checks and balances and the ongoing reports to us as to how the project is going. So I'm confident that this will go as well as the installation of the computer-aided dispatch system did in BOAC, and I thank you for your work on it. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Salzman.
Well, replacing our emergency radios is a very, very important task, and I'm very pleased to see there's a lot of eyes on this contract. It's a big contract, and it's very important, and I want to thank, first of all, Portland voters for approving the bond measure in 2010 that is in making this replacement and a public safety radio system upgrade possible. We need interoperability. We need jurisdictions, police, fire, BOAC jurisdictions to be able to talk to one another, our emergency management offices. This is a feature of the new system. I do appreciate showing us the Technology Oversight Committee benchmarks that they use in reviewing major contracts, and that you have satisfied all of their performance metrics. And I think this has been very responsibly managed, and I continue to expect that to occur throughout the duration of the actual implementation of the new system. So good work. Look forward to it soon. Aye.
Hales.
Well, Portland's a safer city than it was 10 years ago, and that's true of almost all American cities. And that's in part due to good work by our professionals and by the communities they work with, and to some demographic changes that have helped the whole country become a safer place. So where do we get to the next increment of public safety? I think one piece of that answer is information and the ability for us to be nimble and supple and quick in the use of information. So I think having the capabilities that are being built into this system are going to prove, that's going to prove very helpful and a good investment. And I think having the safeguards built into this contract that we've heard about and that we've always going to question you and Ben Berry and anyone else closely about gives us all some reassurance that this is going to give us value for a lot of dollars, but I think dollars well invested. Thanks for the great work. Look forward to the delivery. Aye. Okay, next item.
Item 966, authorize the Bureau of Transportation to acquire certain permanent and temporary rights necessary for construction of the North Burgard Road over Abandoned Railroad and North Burgard Road Storm Sewer Project through the exercise of the city's eminent domain authority.
Mr. Novick.
Mr. Mayor, PBOT has designed a street improvement project at the intersection of North Burgard Road and North Terminal Road, as well as off-street improvements, which includes curbs, sidewalks, and drainage improvements. The project requires acquisition of certain private property interests to construct the project. It's necessary to acquire possession of the easement by February 1st, 2014, so construction will begin on schedule. It's my understanding that owners and tenants of two adjacent properties, Northwest Pipe and Northwest Container Services, are supportive of the project. And additionally, PBOT has met and collaborated with business owners in the project area, including the Port of Portland, Schnitzer Steel, Northwest Container Services, and Waste Express, to coordinate design issues and their effective business operations. And PBOT has also been working through the Portland Freight Committee to disseminate information regarding the project to the freight community. Take it away.
Morning.
Hey, my name is Marty Maloney with the City of Portland Right-of-Way.
A little hard to hear you.
Get a little closer.
Oh, sorry. My name is Marty Maloney. I'm with the PBOT Right-of-Way. Just wanted to address council about the ordinance, the right-of-way ordinance, or condemnation ordinance for the Burgard project, and didn't have much of a presentation. Just wanted to see if you guys had any questions. It's really to acquire the two right away from the two property owners at the corner of North Terminal Road.
I have just a question, just for my own edification. So you're seeking authority to use the city's eminent domain power. Is it your sense that you can do this through a friendly negotiation, or will you have to go to court?
Definitely. I think it'll be through a friendly friendly negotiation. I've spoke to both property owners, and they seemed on board for the project. This basically gives us the ability to offer just compensation to the property owners as well. So,
and just compensation is determined based on an independent market appraisal of the property?
Definitely. Yes, and that's
and a negotiation.
Yeah, exactly. So once we have this, the ordinance is in place, we'll be able to figure out just compensation through. We'll either have a contractor appraisal do the work, or we'll have somebody in-house, depending on the value of the property. So,
thank you.
Refresh my memory, too. I think it is advantageous to the property owner on a tax basis or some other if we do it this way versus just, you know, a bureau manager working out an agreement with someone and writing a check, if it were so simple.
Well, my name is David Olungi from the City of Portland Bridge Group. This project really is a bridge project.
Yeah.
That we replaced an old historic Burgard Road bridge, and we filled in the void below we started that work last year, and we allowed all the dirt to settle for a year. Then we come back and build the road. And then we realized there's about 200-foot gap where there's no sidewalk, because this is a rather undeveloped part of North Portland. So then we found there was funds left over from the bridge project that we could stretch the project limit further, still within compliance with the grant, and fill in this gap and make the connectivity so much better. The property owners have been really benefiting greatly from the project because they have greater access to their properties, a wider street, and they're very willing to accommodate us by just giving us a small piece of their corner so we can make a proper rounded sidewalk intersection. Mm-hmm. The funding is from a grant that came to us from the state, OTIA, Oregon Transportation Investment Act, from 6 to 8 years ago. They gave us funding for 4 bridge projects, and this is the last of those 4 that we're now almost finished with. So instead of walking away, leaving a gap, an obvious gap, we decided to fill it while we have the money.
Good. Good work.
I think the mayor's question, though, I think probably this is more for you, Mr. Roloni, is there an advantage to the property owner when we use eminent domain to acquire the easement as opposed to if we just sort of worked out an agreement, didn't use eminent domain? Is there like a tax advantage?
Basically, well, there wouldn't be the advantage to the property owner, you could say, is if they were to actually redevelop the property, they would actually have to put in these improvements themselves. So there could be an advantage to them that way. Tax-wise, you know, the dedication portion that we acquire, which is very small, they won't have to pay taxes on that anymore. It's included into the right-of-way. Usually, basically, the reason why we do the condemnation ordinance really is the fact that we're able to offer just compensation. You know, it gives us the right to offer to the property owner. It is also, you know, for the purposes of eminent domain to be able to condemn, to protect project timelines, but it's more for setting it up to, you know, to actually offer on the property. And my judgment is on this one is we've already dealt with one property owner from the earlier project, and they were on board with it. I don't think there'll be a problem with them, and the other property owners seemed on board, so I don't think we'll have to be going down that road.
Thank you. Other questions for staff? Thanks very much. Is there anyone signed up to testify?
I did not have a sign-up sheet out.
All right, then, unless there's anyone here to testify on this item, it is an emergency ordinance, so let's vote.
Novick.
Thank you, Mr. Merlotti and Mr. Alonge. Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Salzman.
Aye.
Hales.
OTIA was a good idea. Maybe the state should do something like that again sometime.
Aye.
967, please.
Authorize the Water Bureau to sell and remove a surplus manufactured home from Powell Butte.
Mr. Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a relatively straightforward matter. We're asking the council to authorize the Water Bureau to dispose of yet another piece of surplus property. The property in question is a manufactured home. There is no land associated with the home. This home cannot be used by the Water Bureau, and no other bureau has indicated a desire to purchase it. Per Chapter 5 of the City Code, this home, with your authorization, will be sold through a public sale conducted by Christine Moody's team at Procurement Services. As with all surplus property that this commissioner is selling, proceeds will be placed in our rate stabilization fund, and if we have enough money in that fund, it actually allows us to offset future rate increases. The home has been appraised at $13,499. I have no idea what it will get at auction, although I hope someone bids above the appraised price. Mike Sturr, our chief engineer, is here to answer any questions you may have, and we did give you a photograph of the disassembled home that's up in Powell Butte. I actually looked at this particular property, and what you can't see from the picture, and I don't want to adversely impact the market for this home, is that it's in pretty rough condition on the inside. But for someone who wants to buy it and rehab it, whether they are a for-profit or non-profit developer, they may very well get a good bargain. So Mike's here to answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. I have really very little to add. Commissioner Fish
has adequately explained it. The reason this is an emergency is the next few weeks we will complete testing of Powell Butte 2, and we're going to start backfill and grading, and frankly, the thing is in the way. So we need a means to dispose of it, and I have Barb Gibson here with me from procurement who's been helping with this so she can answer any questions you might have about the public sale itself. Thanks.
Thanks, Barb. This was a caretaker's residence?
Yes, sir. It was a caretaker's residence.
Mm-hmm. And we're not going to need a caretaker up there anymore, or we have a new residence?
As part of the land use process to put Powell Butte 2 in there, we're required to design and build a LEED certified home with a particular look defined in the documents, and that home has been built and is in fact now occupied, so we don't need this any longer.
Great.
Mayor, there was some consideration, and I profess it was originally my idea, that we donate this to a nonprofit to be used for low-income housing. I thought in light of the times we live in, it would be better to put this on the market and have an arm's-length transaction. Secretly, I'm hoping a reputable nonprofit developer comes in and buys it, but they'll have to do it in a arm's-length transaction through a public auction.
Great. Further questions? Thank you. Any testimony on this item?
Yes, Mike.
And we have Joe Walsh.
What's that? Oh, I thought you said something else. Sorry.
My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. There was just, when I read this, Commissioner Fish might have answered my question on this, is I don't like the idea that we have people living on the streets and we have property that we're destroying or selling or getting rid of, or it's in the way and we need to move it. It seems to me that somewhere along the line, there had to be a process months ago where people knew that this property was in the way. And the thinking, I'm trying to visualize the five of you thinking in terms of what can we do with the property instead of just getting rid of it. You know, that's our attitude. If it's in the way, we get rid of it. Well, we have people maybe that could use it. I don't know about the nonprofits and how much we notified them and the legal ramifications of getting someone to bid on it, or at least that they would know it existed. I'm just asking you, since we're living in these times, and these times are not going to get any better, that we start to change our perception. That instead of saying it's in the way, let's get rid of it, how about saying it's in the way, what can we do with it? Can we give it to a nonprofit? How do we get the city attorney to okay that? That kind of thinking. That's what I'm asking. It's $13,000, which is almost nothing in your budgets.
Go ahead. Joe Walsh, Nick Fish, City Commissioner. I appreciate deeply your observation, and it was my impulse. When I became commissioner and learned we had this surplus property, I thought, let's work with a local nonprofit to provide housing for someone who's homeless. Because this was acquired with ratepayer dollars, the opinion we got back was that we should sell it rather than transfer it because we're in the business of providing water and sewer systems, not affordable housing. And as you know, when we sometimes spend ratepayer dollars for something that's non-mission critical, you might be aware that we're criticized in this room for doing so, sometimes sued, and even some have suggested a water district to address that issue. So because it was acquired with ratepayer dollars and because of the legal advice we got, I did not feel I had the latitude to simply give it to a nonprofit. It is my hope, and we have alerted the nonprofit community, and there'll be public notice, that someone comes in and buys it with the intent of providing a home for someone who's formerly homeless, and it is going to be offered at a reasonable price.
Okay. I mean, I don't buy that. I'm sorry, Commissioner Fish. I don't buy any of that because there's so many words in there that lawyers like to use. Like, it was suggested that we do this, or maybe we should do that.
Joe, how can you not buy that? I mean, haven't you been reading in the papers for months and months all the people criticizing the Water Bureau and the Sewer Bureau for high rates and saying that we're spending all sorts of money on things that aren't relevant to providing water and sewer services?
Actually, Joe, you've testified all right,
gentlemen, gentlemen, I know you're both lawyers.
Okay, I'm actually going to ask Joe to just
let me answer this question. You're talking about a house that cost the city $1 million, and you are now selling $400,000. That's the criticism. Mayor, that's the criticism about the PUC. You bought a house and spent $1 million. You're selling it for $400,000. That's a $600,000 loss. You're comparing that to a $13,000 prefab house. Come on.
Okay.
Give me a break.
All right, we got your point. Thank you, Joe. Okay, it's an emergency ordinance. Let's take a roll call.
Novick.
Aye.
Fritz.
I think there's a lot of validity in some of the things that you just said, and if we were being, when we can be collaborative and be sensible about expenditures of rates and Water Bureau money, environmental services money, I think that works better. And we have a different commissioner in charge of the Water Bureau now who is making extraordinary efforts to do things in an open and transparent manner. And so I appreciate that this has been done this way, and I hope we get to continue to collaborate with the Water Commissioner after May. Bye.
Fish.
Mike, thanks for your presentation. Thanks to the A-team at the Water Bureau. And I will accept any and all criticisms about this transaction and file it in the thickest file in my office, Mayor, perhaps yours as well, the title of which is No Good Deed Goes Unpunished. Aye.
Felsman.
Aye.
Hales.
Well, first, thank you, Commissioner Fish, for continuing to methodically and openly clean out the garage of the Water Bureau from a number of issues that have been left in that garage for some time. And now let me say this a little less flippantly. How does government proceed when irresponsible charges are made? The theory behind Commissioner Fish's action here is by being relentlessly responsible, consistent, and clear. We rely on our community to notice and on the news media to transmit that government is trying to be consistently responsible and clear and consistent. And I believe that what Commissioner Fish is doing in this and other questions of how do we carefully steward ratepayers' dollars are all the right things to do. Good deeds are often punished. Sometimes they might be noticed and appreciated by a larger majority who are getting good stewardship of every last dollar that our ratepayers are paying. Thank you. Aye. Okay. Let's move on to 968.
968, establish employment restrictions for the ombudsman position to further safeguard the integrity and independence of the Office of the Ombudsman.
We had a discussion about this at our last meeting.
And the auditor has requested that this be referred to her office.
And she has, and without objection, it is. Sorry, I hadn't noticed that, even though it's right there in plain sight. Okay, now back to item 961, please.
961, amend protected sick time code to clarify various provisions.
If I might frame this, please.
Please.
Thank you. These changes are as a result of going through the administrative rules process, which we're currently doing. There are no substantial changes in the ordinance for protected sick time. We are taking the feedback and making some minor amendments to clarify the intent that the council passed in March. Catherine Reif from the City Attorney's Office and Thomas Bizeau, my Chief of Staff, are here to answer any questions you might have. I'll just run briefly through some of the changes so that you can see the nature of them. We're eliminating references to ORS 652 and 653, which are the definitions of an employee, to be more specific to our definition of employee, clarifying the 240-hour requirement in the definitions so that it's the use and eligibility rather than what defines an employee. We're clarifying the waiting period for new employees to be 90 days. We're changing the we said in the ordinance calendar year, but there's been a request that some companies would like to use fiscal year, and so that seems reasonable. We're amending the definition of healthcare provider to remove a rather ancient reference to spiritual healing that's in the state definition, which is not the intent of our ordinance. We're amending the paid time off to clarify that cash accounts used in the trades may now be used for sick leave, and that the adding a use of sick time change so that an employee who needs to be off for part of a day but is in an industry that they can't perform if they miss part of a day, such as an airlines industry employee, has to take the entire shift off, can't take part of a shift off if the ship or the aircraft has already left. And finally, changing to the administrative rules so that for the future, any changes in the rules are given 30 days notice like any other non-emergency ordinance rather than the 60 days that we had previously envisioned.
Commissioner Fritsch, I have a question, if I could. Since this was originally going to be done on consent, but now we're having the hearing, you also have a companion fall bump request, do you not?
I will do, yes.
And that's for education and outreach?
Yes.
And that will be coming before us in November?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Given the time, and I think Commissioner Fritsch just gave a pretty good overview, I was going to ask Catherine to walk through substantive changes, but I guess I want to ask Catherine, in the section 9.01.20H2, there is the inclusion of there's new language in the inclusion of a vacation pay account as meeting the requirements of our paid time off. And so would those vacation accounts have to give sick pay on the same accruing terms as the requirements of sick time under the ordinance that we passed in last year?
They would. The difference is rather than providing employees time, they're providing them money. But the money is based on an hourly contribution made by
employers. Can you speak closer in the microphone?
Yeah. Pull it down.
Pull it down.
Yeah. There you go.
So short. So, yes, it would have to meet the same requirements for eligibility and accruals. Under our ordinance, the difference is that the contribution is money, it is not time, which is how the ordinance is currently written. The vacation pay accounts are, it's a system whereby employers pay to this account based on the hours worked by an employee for that particular employee. And so, yes, they would still have to meet the same accrual and eligibility requirements.
Okay, and so I don't understand why we would limit the availability of this option to only one sector, the construction trade industry, whereas I'm assuming there might be other businesses or employees subject to collective bargaining agreements that would fall under this as well. So I guess I'm...
The comments,
yeah, I know that there was a very careful discussion about hiring hall exceptions. This council decided that the paid sick leave ordinance should apply to all employees, so there was no hiring hall exception. This kind of looks like a hiring hall exception in a maybe different language, so I'm curious why. Are there not other employers and employees subject to collective bargaining agreements that also use vacation sick leave banks?
This is very similar to a PTO, basically, which is what we put into the ordinance to allow all employers to have the ability to create an account in terms of time, in this case, that they could use for vacation and or sick leave. In the hiring halls, we at the time that we were actually going through this, we had not been given the information that the cash account actually existed, as is the common practice through the hiring hall. The problem with the hiring halls is that they have multiple employers. In the PTO example, which is the most common example that occurs, you have one employer and many employees. In the hiring hall example, you have many employers under one umbrella of that CBA, whatever it may be, and then one employee. And they had created this system already that was in place that basically was like a PTO that had a cash account already in it. At the time that we were creating this ordinance, that wasn't known.
And if I might further comment, so the definition in H now includes either the bank of time, which is the paid time off concept more clearly, and then the contribution made for the construction trades. I anticipate that there may be other minor changes needed over the course of time as we implement this. We haven't been made aware of any private employer who has a money bonus account that employees can use to take paid time off that's not the same as hourly paid time off. If it turns out that that's the case, we could certainly add that as an amendment.
Well, I guess my suggestion would be, why don't we just, because we don't know if there are other employers and employees out there subject to collective bargaining agreements that might have these accounts, why don't we just delete reference to construction trade union in section 02.H2?
Well, I'll tell you one of the reasons why I can't support that. First of all, I think it's bad form to offer an amendment today without any prior discussion of the council. But putting that aside, we've not heard from any other employer that this is an issue. And since this is a very carefully constructed matter, I'm prepared to support the current language, carefully negotiated by this commissioner in charge, Commissioner Fritz. If an employer or trade group comes before us, and they haven't, but if they do at some point and say, we have a unique circumstance, I think the council is fully equipped to then address that issue. But to put in an exception to deal with a problem that has not been identified, I think would be a mistake at this point. And that's why, respectfully, I can't support the amendment.
I'm not asking for an exception. There is an exception. And I'm saying remove the exception, make it apply to any employee covered by a collective bargaining agreement that has a paid time off account. And as to doing this at the last minute, Commissioner Fish, this is a first reading. This was just filed last Friday. So it was on consent calendar, so nobody would even be aware of this if I hadn't pulled it off the consent. So I take exception to somehow I have been involved, and that's why
you didn't
I want
supply
to make
this
sure.
amendment to anyone on the council prior to today.
Well, you know,
You didn't think it worthy to even furnish this language to your colleagues prior to raising it this morning. And I think given all the work that
I'm asking to remove three words, construction trade union.
Well, I think you should offer your amendment.
So, I think it's fair, and this is important. This takes effect January 1st. To somehow say, well, if somebody else comes forward to us between now and January 1st, well, we'll come back and fix it for them. I think that's unfair to everybody who's applied by this ground-setting new ordinance of paid sick leave. People need to know the ground rules now. And that's why we're trying to deal with this amendment today or next week when we vote on it. So I think it's important not to sort of hold out this idea that, well, if you come to us and you have a problem, we'll fix it. Why don't we just remove the reference to one specific sector, and that way we can countenance all potential. We can remove any potential problems for any employers and employees subject to collective bargaining agreements with respect to paid sick.
Commissioner Fritz, can I ask a question about the proposed amendment?
Yeah.
Because you've been handling the process, the public process on this. Is there an employer or a trade group that has raised the concern that Commissioner Saltzman is addressing today through his proposed amendment?
Not to my knowledge.
Commissioner Saltzman, is there an employer or trade group that has spoken to you and raised this concern?
Not to my knowledge, but I know that there was a lot of discussion in the development of this ordinance by Providence Health Systems. I know they had an issue with their home health care workers, and it sounded very similar, but like I said, I mean, this was on consent calendar. We've only had a time to go through it in the last few days. I'd be happy to, you know, like I said, there's probably not a lot of awareness that this is happening today, and that's why one reason I pulled it off the consent calendar, and two, I just question why we're narrowly crafting it to apply to simply one employment sector, and why not just remove the language and allow all employment sectors where there's employers and employees with collective bargaining agreements that may have these same type of vacation sick leave accounts? Why not permit them the same advantage?
Tom, do you want to address that? Or?
There is a significant difference, and the difference is that you could have other collective bargaining agreements out there, and they could actually be something that's crafted for an individual employer with all the employees. But in this case, that's not what we're talking about. we're talking about many employers under one umbrella. It's a totally different situation.
Tom, and
we have basically covered the individual employer with the PTO requirement, and allowing them to do the PTO. It's an elegant solution to all of the situations is already built into the ordinance and will be built into the administrative rules as well.
So, Catherine, in your opinion, is this a major substantive change, this provision?
I think it is a substantive change because we are.
Can we find
The change.